Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program, how the state's effort to shut down the revolving door of low-level inmates coming in and out of state prisons will impact Fresno and other Central Valley counties whose jails will now house those inmates. We talked to Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims. And Kern County's fight to stop Los Angeles from spreading its waste on the county's rich farmland. Plus, an oral tribute to Valley Vets. But first, some say California Governor Jerry Brown is putting his career on the line by signing legislation aimed at reducing the state's prison population. The governor said the state's prison system had become a revolving door for low-level offenders and parole violators who were often released in months. Brown says the current system wasted money and did little to rehabilitate inmates. His solution? The Public Safety Realignment Act. It allows nonviolent, non-serious, and non-sex offenders to serve their sentence in county jails instead of state prisons. And the state is giving the counties money for jail beds and alternative programs. We talked to Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims about its impact on Fresno County. Sheriff Mims, thanks so much for joining us today to discuss this issue.
Thank you for having me.
Have we started realignment yet? Have we started receiving prisoners?
Realignment started October 1st, and this is a state system where we receive state inmates, those who normally would have gone on to some kind of state correctional facility, now will come and stay in a local county jail. And this affects our local jail in three different ways. First of all, when judges sentence inmates to jail and they are non-serious, non-violent, non-sexual offenders, they will do their time in the county jail, which changes California law because prior to October 1st, the most anybody could do in a local jail was 1 year. But now those people can stay in the local jail for numerous years. We already have somebody sentenced to 11 years.
And they're going to be in county jail?
They will be in the county jail. So that's the first way that it's affected us. The second way is how it affects county probation. People coming out of prison, that if they're the same people that would come out anyway, that would normally be supervised by state parole, will now be supervised by county probation. So they will get about 49% of the caseload that once belonged to state parole. And the purpose was to send these people back to be supervised locally with local programs. And the feeling was the local government county can do a better job than the state could. Now, the third way it affects the county jail is state parolees who are currently on parole. This is prior to October 1st. If they're violated, they don't go back to state prison. They come back to county jail for up to 180 days. So needless to say, our population in the county jail has risen a lot. Now, we were able to open up a closed floor in the jail using state money. That floor held 432 people. Not all of those are state inmates. However, we're watching very closely our population, because the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, CDCR, gave us estimates of the number of people they felt we were going to be getting impacting the jail. It was 60 for the month of October. We are well over 100. So that's important to know how the numbers impact us, because funding comes along with that. They gave us funding based on their estimates, which were low.
So they gave you funding for 60. But you're already
over 100, yes.
With the problems that we already have at the Fresno County Jail with overcrowding, it's my understanding that we are already in early release of some jail inmates.
We are in that situation. And one thing I let people know is the past three sheriffs have been involved in early release, Sheriff McGarian, Sheriff Pierce, and now me. So it's not something new. It has something that has been in the news a lot more, but it's not something new. I did close floors because of the economy. You know, we could not afford the staffing that it takes to run the full jail system the way we used to. So the state money did help opening one floor. We plan on opening a second floor in April using state money. So that's another 432 beds. That helps us with our local issue for releasing local inmates for a short period of time until we build up those state inmates we're responsible for that will eventually take up that room.
You know, it almost seems amazing when you look at the numbers. You say when you open a floor of the jail, that's 400 and something beds. We seem to fill that up in absolutely no time.
You're right. In fact, if the saying, if you build it, they will come, is accurate in corrections. And that's why there's such a focus on programming and, you know, trying to get people into evidence-based programs that probation is running to keep people from reoffending. We're going to measure our success in a very different way. Before, we would measure our success. How many arrests do we make? How long can we put them away? How long can we keep them in jail? That is the old world. The new world we live in is measuring our success on how do we keep people from reoffending, affecting recidivism. So it's evidence-based. All the programs that we're looking at have worked somewhere else. And the feeling is as bad as the public feeling is and the skepticism that maybe even I have about the state numbers, we have to give it a chance to work because that's the world we're living in now. We have to give it a chance to work. And if it comes to the point where I realize this isn't working, we need to do something different, I'm going to be very vocal about that.
The other point is, with the number of jail inmates we have, and we're already estimating that we are going to get more prisoners from the state. What does that mean for us? I mean, the state is notorious for underfunding. So are we going to have the funds for the programs needed for these inmates? And are they going to be supervised?
That is a key concern, Juanita. The State Sheriff's Association supported realignment with the caveat that we get sustained funding, full funding for our new responsibilities. We do not have that sustained funding right now. For instance, we don't know that after this fiscal year, counties will be receiving any money. There are absolutely no guarantees. So we are involved in putting a constitutional amendment on the ballot in November to get funding earmarked. I mean, it will be specifically for realigning these state inmates. The appropriate funding. The state can say, we gave you money, but is it enough? That's why we're measuring our numbers very, very carefully to let them know what the real impact has been.
Are we in danger? Is there a danger of counties getting these extra prisoners, and then somewhere down the line, the funding dries up? And if that happens, what does that mean?
Well, that means we will no longer be able to fund the floor in the jail that the state provided money for, because the county certainly doesn't have money to replace it. I think it would be a bad move by Governor Brown to not send the money or not do everything he can to make sure we get the money. Because remember, this is kind of his legacy. And if it doesn't work, that's going to be a bad legacy to live with after he is no longer governor. So I think he's going to be doing everything he can to make this work because it truly is his program and his plan.
What I'm trying to get at, is there the possibility or the risk that the counties could end up with these extra inmates out on the street with no programs if this program doesn't work the way it should work?
If we don't get the funding for the inmates, either to stay in jail or to continue the evidence-based programs that we have planned, there is that danger. However, I don't want, you know, people to run around with their hair on fire worrying about something like that. We can what if things all day long. But the Chief Probation Officer, Linda Penner, and I are committed to trying to make this work. We're pretty pragmatic about this. This is what we're this is the hand we've been dealt. And so we've got to try our best to make it work. And believe me, Chief Penner is not shy about making her opinion known either. And if it's not working and if it is going to endanger the citizens of Fresno County, we will make sure our voices are heard to make a change.
You know, as sheriff, do you understand? I'm sure you do. I shouldn't ask it that way, but I'm sure you do. Understand the way the public feels? I mean, we have watched this whole prison situation or jail situation unfold. And you're right. It happened under previous sheriffs as well. This constant releasing of inmates and whether or not they're nonviolent or low level, you know, these people still go back out on the street and they still break into people's home and they steal their cars. And in one case, we did see a inmate who was released early who committed a serious crime, a homicide. So understanding the way the public feels about this and that they're very apprehensive.
I absolutely understand it. And remember, I'm a Fresno County resident also, and my family lives in Fresno County. And I use an illustration when people tell me, you know, well, how do certain people get released? And I would love to have the crystal ball, Juanita, to be able to predict somebody who is a property thief to measure whether or not they now are going to go out and commit some kind of violent person's crime. And we don't have those kinds of instruments. But one day, for instance, we get two people that are arrested. And one was a vehicle thief. I mean, he had stolen several vehicles. The other person had tried to abduct a 12-year-old girl at gunpoint. Now, I have a choice. Which one of those people am I going to keep? And it's not a hard question to answer for me. I'm going to protect our children at all costs. And I had to make that decision. Is it going to be the car thief or is it going to be the man that tried to abduct a 12-year-old little girl? And they're not easy questions to answer. They're not easy decisions to make. But I'm the sheriff and I have to make those hard decisions based on everything I absolutely have to do with what I've got, we do the best we can.
What will it take? What is it going to take? Because I do believe that people are at this point. What is it going to take for us to resolve this issue where we don't have to let jail inmates out early? You know, programs will work for some inmates, but you're going to have another group that the programs aren't going to work for. So what is it going to take for us as a county to resolve this issue?
Yeah, I hope we're on that road with these evidence-based programs that probation has now gotten state money to institute. I always look, and when I speak to groups, I really put inmates into three separate categories. Our first group are those who offend. They're probably first-time offenders. They get in trouble. They get caught doing something, and we'll never see them again. Those are the first group. And I'm going to move to the third group. And these are the people that are no program is going to help. They've committed such a heinous crime, and it's so awful. They need to be taken out of the public and kept locked up forever and ever. And it's that middle group we need to take a look at, the ones that can be helped the most with certain kinds of programs. We want them to move into that first group and never offend again, rather than have them move into that third group where we have to keep them locked up forever. And there are several good programs that Chief Penner have put in place that I hope work. Nobody, believe me, there's nobody in Fresno County that wants to stop releasing inmates more than I do.
But again, is this an issue of, and it always comes back to that money, funding, for you to be able to get the funds you say you need from the county to run the jail the way you say it needs to be run? Isn't that a major part of the solution?
The major part of not being able to fill up our current facility is definitely money. For instance, the two floors that we now have closed cost $4 million each to run. So that's another $8 million that the county doesn't have to open up those floors. Now, remember, in April, we'll be able to open up one of those floors that will help us out. But again, along comes the responsibility to house state inmates. So that leaves one floor that the county could, should they find the money, open up for another 432 beds. But I will tell you that even when we had every single one of the floors open, we were at the verge of having to release inmates early because we did not have the room. No matter how much jail space we build, we're going to fill it up. It's going to fill up. We're also looking at contracting with Coalinga because they have a community corrections facility out there. They are in the process of giving me some numbers right now. And the third thing we're doing is looking at trying to get some AB 900 money. That is money the state had set aside for reentry facilities to help counties build capacity. So we have plans A, B, and C in place for extra room if we need it and if we have the funding to purchase it.
So it all comes down to the money issue.
It does.
Is there a point where we know the state is in tough financial trouble, and so is the county, but at some point where you just have to find a way, you have to find the money, you have to find the funds and say, look, this is important. We've had too many close calls when it comes to the early release of inmates, and this is something we have to make a priority.
Well, I've done my best and been very vocal and end up in the news a lot about challenging the Board of Supervisors to find the money for that, because I'm in the position right now where to have appropriate emergency response with deputy sheriffs or, you know, open up a floor in the jail. And, of course, the question is, why do you have deputies if you can't keep them in jail? Well, the deputies are answering very serious felony calls for service, people that don't get released from jail every single day. And I have to look out for their safety, make sure they have the coverage. And it's a complicated issue when you start looking at finances and how it works in the county. It's not like a private business, and it leaves people scratching their heads sometimes about how it all works. But I truly, to make sure that I have deputy sheriffs out there answering calls for service and responding to emergencies and keep what I can open from the jail, it's a balancing act. Also, how much really can sheriffs and DAs and probation chiefs do? I tell people parents have to parent, preachers have to preach, and teachers have to teach. It truly is everybody's responsibility to do their part to keep people from offending in the first place. And so many times we look back, and especially teachers. I thought I wanted to be a teacher, by the way. I don't know if you knew that or not. I worked as a teacher's aide in a second grade classroom. And those teachers knew. They knew which children were probably going to go on to jail. Those teachers knew. And it boils down to parenting issues. It boils down to so many social things that are the personal responsibility of individuals. And, you know, I can sure take care of them once they commit that crime. But, of course, my preference is that those crimes aren't committed in the first place.
But on the other hand, and I think part of it is, too, is that there have been so many high-profile cases where we have seen, and not just county workers, but we've seen the system fail, and we've seen the system fail at the cost of someone's life or at the cost of someone's innocence, in the case of J.C. Lee Dugard.
Yes.
And different situations like that. And so for the public, when they see that, they hold, whether or not it's the fair thing to do, but they hold parole officers, sheriff's deputies, police. They just hold you to this standard of protect.
Right. And what where the public is right now, as we take a look and as I move around, the public wants the same level of service, but they don't want to pay for it. You know, that it really is a problem where expectations are the same, but the funding available doesn't meet those expectations. And that's really where we are. For instance, the sheriff's office is one-fourth the size, one-fourth lost the personnel since I took office. We have lost 25% of the people that worked in the sheriff's office since 2007. And you just cannot expect to be able to continue a same level of service when you lose that many people, that much funding. It's in jails. I'm talking about jails costs. In 2006, the Board of Supervisors were considering building additional space onto our jail. The cost was $500 million. Jails are extremely expensive to build. In fact, the only bed that costs more money to build than a jail bed is a hospital bed. And I think people are just tired of it. I'm working with Mike Reynolds again to try and come up with some kind of alternative housing for inmates. And it kind of is shades of Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona. But for instance, if it's someplace where it meets the local health and safety standards for residential living, why wouldn't it be good enough to hold inmates there to reduce the cost of what it takes to build a facility? So we tried in 2008 with Proposition 6, and it didn't pass. So what Fresno County might want to pass, the rest of the state may not. And so that's what we're facing.
Looking at alternatives.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks so much for your time, Sheriff. We appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having me, Juanita.
Now, joining us now to continue this discussion is Mike Reynolds, the co-author of The Three Strikes Law, and Dr. Mark Kleinman, professor of public policy at the UCLA Meyer and Renee Luskin School of Public Affairs. First of all, before I ask you to this first question, I'd like to give the public the opportunity to discuss this issue. And what do you think about this new realignment program that will have state prison inmates being housed in county jails, including the Fresno County Jail? You can give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989. Or email us at talk@kvpr.org. Now, from the both of you, Dr. Kleinman?
Yes.
Yes,
thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, let's start with you, Mike. What is your take on this whole realignment program? Do you think it's something that needs to be given a chance? Do you think it'll work for the counties?
Well, most people that walk down the street don't understand the difference between jail and prison. They just assume behind bars is behind bars, and that's the way that works. And they don't care where they're at. Everyone's got to be somewhere. As long as bad guys are behind bars, we're happy. Otherwise, law-abiding citizens are the ones that are behind bars trying to protect ourselves. So what they fail to understand is the county facilities that are run by the 58 various counties throughout the state, and all but two are run by the sheriffs, are basically only allowed historically to hold a person up to 1 year in time. And they're designed for a lower level facility. They're not designed to hold people 5 years or 10 years. Now what they're doing is moving state offenders in a resentencing program into counties that will be there for very long term, thus filling those facilities. And it's no underestimate that what this will do is cause early release. Now, when that happens, you basically have this situation. Laws without penalties become no laws at all. And that's basically what this is doing, is discounting the penalty price for committing crime. And it will impact primarily property crimes. That means car theft and any second-degree burglaries. I can sit here and go through the laundry list. But basically, property crime will almost not be prosecuted. And when it is, you'll see very little time served for it.
Dr. Kleinman, you've written much about prison reform. What do you think of this? Do you think it's a good first step? Do you think it's the wrong move at this time?
There's one good thing about it, which is that under the previous system, the counties were essentially able to dump all their costs on the state. As soon as somebody got sent off to state prison, he was off the county's books. And then in particular, the county probation departments had every incentive to get people revoked and send them off to prison because the county didn't have to pay for it. The new system is going to leave the fiscal responsibility on the counties, which is where it belongs. But the whole notion that the only way to have public safety is to have people behind bars is a recipe for failure. what we learned from the HOPE program in Hawaii and its imitators elsewhere is it's perfectly possible to maintain people if you watch them closely and sanction every violation. Perfectly possible to maintain people in the community in a law-abiding fashion without paying the room and board bill. And we ought to be focusing, and I hope the new fiscal incentives will lead counties to focus on the ways that we can control people's behavior without feeding and housing them. And that's the direction I think we ought to be moving in. So what we really need is not prison space or jail space. What we really need is space to hold people doing short terms, a couple of days a week, a couple of weeks, for violating their probation or parole conditions. But if we had that, we could massively reduce both crime and the number of people behind bars.
You know, but as we mentioned before, we all know there will be some inmates who will respond to this, and we all know there will be some who don't. And it comes down to, what do you tell the person who ends up being victimized by what is considered to be a low-level offender, Mike?
Well, it depends what you call low-level offenses. Frankly, an auto theft is considered a low-level offense. But this is the biggest investment that most people make in their lives other than the purchase of a home. You spend $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 on a car and then spend 5 years paying for it at great sacrifice and cost to your family, and then some jerk rips it off and he's out faster than the police can do the paperwork. I mean, what incentive is there for anybody to really buy a car or any other property? And ultimately what you see is a devaluation of the kind of property that people own, and they will buy clunkers rather than a good car. As a result, you have fewer cars being sold, fewer people building those cars, and jobs that create those cars. Now, I take that all the way down the line, whether it's cars, television sets, any personal property. Once it becomes quite apparent that it can be easily ripped off, then people will stop acquiring that property.
Now, Dr. Kleinman, you've said before, to be able to change a person's behavior, the punishment needs to be consistent, enforced quickly, and it has to be enforced fairly. Will this do that? I mean, that's part of the problem with our system now. You know, yesterday, for instance, I was listening to the verdict and the reaction from the Michael Jackson trial. And you had the L.A. District Attorney mentioning this new realignment measure and saying that a person like Dr. Conrad Murray would be one of those. He's been convicted, but he'll be out in no time. And so when people see this, and even though what Lindsay Lohan does is a low offense, but people keep seeing this revolving door, people coming in and out, no consequences, no punishment, that does have an impact.
Right. You're describing the consequences of Proposition 13, which guarantees that we fill our prisons with old, retired criminals and have no space for the young, active criminals. We need to get serious about the fact that we cannot build our way out of the crime problem, but we can use the capacity we have and the authority of the courts more effectively than we're using it now. We know how to do that. This is not speculation. These are programs that actually operate and work. We just have to put them into effect. Now, my hope is the realignment process will encourage the counties to do that. But the realignment process alone doesn't accomplish anything.
Okay. Let's hear from Eugene, your comment on this issue.
Yeah, let me say first, I worked in the prison system for 16 years, and incarceration is no solution, okay? In fact, when the gentleman stated, well, you invest $35,000 for a car, you know, that's what you spend per year to keep the guy in prison. Doing that calculation, you could pay back the citizen $35,000 for the car and still be ahead of the game. You understand what I'm saying? You have to figure out a way to reform the individuals to convince them not to come back to prison. And stricter laws, stricter incarceration programs is not the solution. You need to, well, it's up to the individual to change their mind that they don't want to come back. There has to be a certain amount of self-determination within the offender, but then there have to be adequate programs in place for teaching them skills for proper behavior patterns, and the release program, when the individual is paroled back on the street, you know, they have to go back to where they were arrested, and generally where they were arrested is where they have most of their crime buddies, but that's the way the law reads. You need to change that program as well so that they can be released someplace where they don't have any drug connections. Most of the offenders, 70% of the people in prison are somehow drug-related, okay? So that means first you start with decent drug programs to get them off of what's causing them to act in a negative manner. Then you teach them proper behavior, a job, how to read and write is a good one, but just the basic concept, well, break the law and we're going to throw you into prison. We've been doing that for the last, since the Three Strikes program came in, and it's not helping. It's proven that that is a non-effective program. They keep coming back anyway. So something's wrong with that picture.
Okay, Eugene, thank you for your comments. And Mike?
Since Three Strikes passed, the California crime, which was the third highest in the nation as far as California goes, dropped within 3 years down to about number 41. And today, California crime is half the rate that it was prior to Three Strikes. And the ironic part of that is when you have half the crime, not only do you have half the victims, but you have half the people that would have committed those crimes. And so you have fewer people going to prison because there's just simply fewer crimes. So the biggest deterrent there has been the threat of a greater sentence. And there's three studies on our website, which is threestrikes.org, including an FBI study, a Harvard study, and the Chicago Institute study that all show that while the state recidivism rate is at 70% every 18 months, second strikers, are actually coming back at about 50% of that rate. It's about half that rate. So it's quite clear that Three Strikes has had a very big impact on deterring criminal behavior.
Now, Dr. Kleinman, a key to this program working really is the funding and the programs. And counties are definitely going to have the funding to put these programs in place because most counties, like Fresno County, they've had their budgets cut, slashed, to the point where there are very few or, if any, existing programs. So isn't this a big part of having this whole thing work?
In my view, no.
No.
Neither having more cells to put people in, nor having lots of drug treatment programs and education programs and job placement programs is the key. The key is to have a system where somebody who's on the street knows that there are rules, knows that there are consequences for breaking those rules, knows those consequences can happen right away. Hope in Hawaii gets a bunch of methamphetamine using long-term active criminals to stop using meth at a rate of about 80%. It's about four times as good as any drug treatment program. Very few of those people actually need drug treatment. What they need is a clear message that if they use today, they're going to prison tonight, and they're going to jail tonight. And that's what we've got to put in place. The last time we had our current crime rate, we had one-fifth as many people in prison. No country in the world has as many prisoners as we do. We know how to do better. And if we spend all of our time talking about who's going to get one budget, we're not going to be focused on what works.
Okay.
Look, could I touch on that for a moment?
Yes, and then we'll have one more question.
Yeah, keep in mind, California's prison population at 170,000 has remained the same for the last decade, over 10 years. And as far as new prisons, California has only built one new prison in the last 17 years, and that's Delano 2. It's also built two new hospitals, but we're at 33 prisons. And keep in mind, prior to Three Strikes, the 5 years prior to Three Strikes, California funded and built 19 new prisons. After the passage of Three Strikes, only one has been built. So you went 17 years and built one prison. If you did that for schools, where would we be? If you did that for roads, where would you be? So this is an infrastructure problem that, yeah, the state needs more prisons. And it's not a pretty sight. No one likes to spend on prisons, but it is a fact. And as far as California's incarceration rates, they're about in the middle of the pack. They're not higher than anybody else's. And in fact, there are many states that have a higher prison population than California, even though they have a lower overall population.
Okay. Before we wrap up, I know, Mike, this is something you did want to touch on, but, you know, there is a proposed ballot initiative out there that is being worked on, and it would limit the state's three strikes law, and it would reserve the toughest penalty, 25 years, for what they call the baddest of the bad. You know, there are some people who think three strike does need to be have some kind of reform.
Well, keep in mind, this would be on the heels of this realignment program. And I think that to have such a huge change in the social structure of our inmate population this quick, and then to dump a change in three strikes on top of it would be the proverb of insult to injury. I mean, you'd really be perhaps making a huge mistake. The timing on this couldn't have been worse. They really should see exactly what's going to happen after this realignment and then take a look at making any changes on three strikes, because literally three strikes is about the only thing that's keeping inmates in now.
Okay.
Well, on one point, Mike and I agree. Now is not the time to fix the idiotic provisions of three strikes. The time was 15 years ago. But better, sooner is better than later. The fact that we are currently filling our prisons with people, some of whom are still in persistent comas, rather than keeping active criminals in prison, is just insane. And the time to fix it is now, not later.
Well, I want to thank both of you gentlemen for this discussion this morning. Thank you, Dr. Kleinman, for joining us. We appreciate your input. Yes. And I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Kern County has a poop problem, and it is not even theirs. Since the 1990s, Los Angeles County has been trucking its human waste and industrial waste over the Grapevine and into Kern County, about 450 tons every year. The treated waste is then smeared on the farmland. While L.A. sewage treatment agencies call the sludge fertilizer, Kern County growers see it as a threat to the environment and economy, saying food processors will not buy crops grown on land where the waste has been applied. Kern County water experts also call it a threat to their drinking and irrigation water. Kern County residents fed up with being dumped on passed what is called Measure E, a ban on applying the treated waste on land. The measure was passed in 2006, but has been tied up in the courts ever since. We also spoke with Mark Nations, Chief Deputy Counsel in Kern County, about the county's legal case and where it stands now. Thanks for joining us, Mr. Nations.
Certainly.
Kern County voters passed Measure E in 2006. How does it make you feel that 5 years later you all are still involved in this legal battle?
Well, it's a disappointment, I suppose. This is one of the few things that voters agreed on in such a high percentage. It was like 83% of the populace wanted this, and it's frustrating not to be able to allow that to go into effect.
Do you have any hopes that this is going to be resolved legally anytime soon?
Soon, I guess, is a relative term, and it looks like it's going to be a matter of two or three more years. We are on appeal right now on a couple of pretty critical issues, and if those are resolved one way or the other, it could go a long way to resolving the case.
What are those issues? What are those critical issues?
As you may know, the court in Tulare issued a preliminary injunction. We argued that the complaint is barred by the statute of limitations, in that these same claims were brought in the federal court. The federal court resolved all of the federal claims and then sent the state claims back to the state. It wouldn't resolve them. It just refused to decide them. It's our contention that they did not refile in state court soon enough, and that, therefore, the complaint is barred. The other issue has to do with whether the state's solid waste management regulations preempt the county's initiative ordinance. If either of those go in our favor, then the case is pretty much over. If we lose on the preemption issue, if the court decides it and says that the ordinance is preempted, then the case is over.
Now, part of the problem with this is with Measure E on whole, some believe that it's not really giving L.A. County any kind of incentive to do anything.
I think that's a pretty reasonable assumption to make. I mean, I know they have a project down there where they're actually injecting sewage sludge into the kind of a geologic formation, but it's really a small percentage of their total waste stream. As part of the effort to fight off the request for an injunction, we made the observation that they could be composting this material rather than land applying it. They also have a lot of other destinations they could take it to, and their response to all of that really came down to, well, those are too expensive. And so it's really a matter of money, and so as this really is apparently the most cost-effective way for them to dispose of this, at least through their own analysis. And so there really is no incentive for them to do anything.
You're talking about what is best for L.A., and I think that's probably what's upsetting to the people of Kern County, because this is all based on what's better for the people in Los Angeles and not what the people in Kern County want.
That's true, and it wouldn't matter which county it was. If it was, you know, Riverside County or Tulare County or any of the other counties that border Kern County, if they were trucking that stuff over here and land applying it, the argument would be the same. You know, what's best for the citizens of Kern County? Well, it's not to land apply it, obviously, or you hit the nail on the head in terms of they're not too concerned about what's best for the citizens of Kern County.
You know, what about this whole issue or the whole idea that another county can impose its cast-offs onto another county?
Right. Well, that's really, it goes to the heart of the issue, and that's why they're saying, well, the state law preempts your ordinance because we can't let one county dictate to another county whether or not it can do this sort of thing. That's why we have statewide regulation in place, is so that type of dispute doesn't arise. It is kind of a new issue, I suppose, in the sense that this doesn't happen very often. I know I believe it's up in Northern California, a county up there passed an ordinance essentially restricting the amount of solid waste it could take at its landfills. And I guess a lot of the more heavily populated counties up there had been sending their solid waste there, so they don't like being told they can't do that, so they filed a lawsuit as well. But that's the nature of the dispute, and that's why we need to decide if the state law preempts this or not. Because if it doesn't, then I think you'd see a lot more counties pass a similar thing.
Now, you're okay with the whole issue of composting this waste or burning it?
I think it's incineration, I'm told, is probably the best way to deal with it, because you end up with the residual ash from the burning process, and then you haul that off to a Class 1 hazardous waste disposal site, and you put it in there. What we're doing now is we are taking that same toxic-type material, albeit in a less concentrated form, and we're putting it on perfectly good farm ground and then planting crops in it and irrigating it with treated sewage effluent from the city of Bakersfield. And we just don't think that's healthy.
And joining us now is former State Senator Dean Flores from Shafter. Senator Flores, thanks so much for joining us for this discussion.
Thanks for having me.
Now, how did this all get started? Why didn't L.A. dump its waste in L.A. County or someplace closer?
Well, it got started with some very, very ill-advised supervisors in Kern County that sold L.A. the land. I mean, the reality is that it's one thing for a county to treat its own solid waste, but it's a whole other thought to allow another county or another city as big as Los Angeles, the second largest city in the nation, to truck over the equivalent of filling a Staples Center up in Los Angeles to a 4,000-acre site to dump all of its sewage there every single day. And it just was a very bad decision by the Board of Supervisors, and it's one that we're continuing to pay for. It's one we had to go to the voters and try to reverse.
But, you know, the voters did.
They now, did, 83% of them.
Right, right. And I think that's got to be frustrating when you have a vote like that and the people's wish or the people's voice still isn't being heard. That's got to be frustrating.
Well, it was. I mean, we ran this initiative to send a statement and a very loud statement to the court. We know that Los Angeles will never pull back its ability to dump all of their solid waste on 4,600 acres of land that they own in Bakersfield. They know that's the cheapest alternative. They've considered looking at Arizona. They're now taking about 10% of it into the port, where they're injecting it into some areas that have, if you will, no detrimental effect on the environment. You know, our question simply is, here the voters have spoken. Here's a very large city, you know, pushing its will on a very small, poor, rural county under the thought that it's recycling. And the reality is that land applying sludge isn't recycling. It's a pollution transfer. It's a pollution transfer from this very large industrialized urban center to a center where we grow our food for the nation, which I think is a very dangerous precedent.
I mean, does human waste make a good fertilizer? I mean, L.A. County is saying that this stuff is safe. You all maintain otherwise.
Well, look, I mean, here's the interesting thing. You know, the mayor of Los Angeles and others who continue to push this policy forward have a policy of planting 1 million trees in Los Angeles. It's part of the green initiative there. So you would think that if this stuff was so good as a fertilizer, you'd keep some of it on your side of the boundary to at least plant the trees. They're not doing that. They're simply finding a way to push more environmentally hazard material over to a county that has to deal with the wreckage of that at some point in time. And so, you know, if Los Angeles really felt that it needed to have a fertilizer, they clearly have the ability to keep it within their borders, create that fertilizer on their side of the fence. And unfortunately, they have chosen a county that had some very bad leadership at the very beginning of this process that invited them in, opened the gates to a place called Green Acres, and obviously it's not so green. I mean, at the end of the day, it's going to really, I think, be detrimental to the folks living around that particular area.
Then what is your, do you see an alternative at this point? As we stated, well, we've heard the whole court issue. Does it look like at this point it's going anywhere? So the people of Kern County, do you have an alternative at this point?
Well, we do. I mean, we have a couple alternatives. We continue to fight in court. We're very thankful that the county continues to push this forward. I think the Board of Supervisors now recognize that this was a fight we shouldn't have been in from the first place. And now we're making amends by keeping us in court and keeping this issue in front of judges. But Los Angeles has very deep pockets. They see the value of pushing their sludge into an area on a 120-mile trip that, you know, basically happens every single day, a couple hundred times a week. And so, you know, our thought is the courts will continue to battle this. It's going to be a long and slow process, but in the end we'll win. But I think the real answer here is a political answer. And, you know, we need to find in this next mayoral election, we need to make sure that, you know, whoever that mayor is has an idea of what they ought to be doing in terms of taking care of their own waste and not pushing it on to the poorest county right next door. And so I think politically the candidates I've talked to thus far all seem to be saying that there has to be a better way for LA to do this other than imposing its will on a poor county next door. So I think there's some semblance. Now, can we get the bureaucrats at the Department of Sanitation and others to do something different? That will be a big question, but that's why you need a mayor who actually has environmental credentials that speak not just for their own city, but speak for the entire state of California. So, you know, we're hopeful that, you know, whoever ends up in that particular seat this next round will see that, you know, it just doesn't do well to be a bad neighbor when you're dumping all of your waste over the fence next door and somehow think that's okay, you know, politically. I mean, L.A. is a Democratic city. It has a lot of environmentalists in it. It has folks who actually would probably frown upon the practice of imposing, you know, environmental hazards on the neighbor next door. But that hasn't been put forward by the leadership thus far in Los Angeles. So hopefully we'll be able to change that, and hopefully there'll be a political decision on this. We can save all the taxpayers the money in court, and we'll make just what I would call a good neighborly, you know, type of decision, and that is everyone should take care of their own waste within their own borders, and they shouldn't be able to export it to the next county next door. And that's kind of just plain old politics. So I think hopefully we'll be able to see folks do something better next time.
Okay. Well, we'll continue to follow this issue. Former State Senator Dean Flores, thanks so much for joining us today.
You got it. Thank you very much.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Students at Fresno State are getting the opportunity to participate in history by telling the stories of Valley veterans. Here to talk about this interesting project is Gary Rice, associate professor at Fresno State, and Keelan Hanlon, an ag communications major at Fresno State. And we also have Chelsea Cushing, also a student at Fresno State. First of all, with you, Professor Rice, how did this whole project get started?
Well, about 2 years ago, I had an opportunity to get a grant from the university, and I tried to come up with a project that would have special local meaning and also benefit our students. And I think I've never seen a part of the country that was so patriotic about its veterans. We have tons of veterans around here. We set up the Central California War Veterans Oral History Project, and since we have begun it, students have done over 200 of these, all following guidelines of oral histories done for the National Archives or Presidential Libraries.
Okay. And Keelan, we're going to listen to a piece that you did, but before we do that, tell me a little bit about what you did.
Well, I interviewed Robert Lee McCracken for my first veteran, and he told me his story. He had a great story. He served in the Vietnam War. He was a medical corpsman for the Navy, and he had some great stories about he delivered the first baby ever born on one of the bases when he was freshly there out of training. And he also was on the USS Yorktown, flying with the helicopter squadron, rescuing people off there. Needed a great story to tell.
Okay, well, let's listen in, to a portion of that great story.
We were submarine warfare, tried to detect any enemy submarines that were in the area. We never did. We did have a Russian trawler that was out there with us that was bugging us all the time. It was a spy ship. In fact, we had a funny story on that. The USO show came on board. Ann Margaret, Johnny Rivers, and Ben Hogan came on board. And our rear admiral, nice guy, he radios this Russian trawler and tells them that we have this USO show and they're welcome to come and see it. And the skipper of the Russian trawler radioed back, and he says, "Sorry, we can't make it this time, but when you have the Bolshevik dancers on board," he says, "we will be there." So it was kind of battering back and forth.
Now, Keelan, what do you think when it comes to history and learning history? What is it about doing the project this way than just reading the book or doing a paper on it?
Well, I think this has been an amazing experience for me. Just from personal experience, I have never had a family member or close relative really that has been involved in the military. And being able to meet with this gentleman, to hear his story, and to hear how he was part of making history, and to know that by listening to his story and transcribing it, there's now going to be a permanent record in the library for generations to come to look at. And it's really given me a great eye-opening opportunity of hearing the story firsthand and a great connection with the veteran.
Yeah. Dr. Rice, now what happens with these? Will people be able to continue to go to the library and listen to these, or are you just going to have a special display for Veterans Day?
No, as a matter of fact, these oral histories, the transcripts, and even some of the clippings, letters, et cetera, that veterans have given us will be kept forever in a special collection at Madden Library, open to the public, researchers, students from around the world. It's something that'll be there forever.
Now, Chelsea, also a student, you just graduated from Fresno State. Now, you completed four of these oral histories with local veterans.
That is correct. I had two gentlemen in the Navy, one in the Army, and also one in the Marines.
What do you think? What did you learn from this?
I gained a personal respect for each one of them. As Keelan said, I didn't have anybody very close in my family that served in the military. Getting them to know them on a personal level and then also on a military level, they opened up to me. They told me things that they'd said they'd never told anybody in their family. And they all thanked me to be able to tell their story. I've had some gentlemen, one gentleman that was really sick, and he was so grateful to be able to tell a story to pass on to his kids and grandkids.
I'd have to say this is really, a great way for young people not just to learn history but to experience history.
Well, that is very true. And oftentimes students will go out and interview the veteran, and then they will do more research themselves just because they got fascinated about it. And I also hear from the veterans, too. They come up and say, hey, thanks for this project. I really love talking to your students. And I think some friendships have actually come out of it as well.
Is it true about that, friendships? Because I would think for these veterans, as you mentioned, so many of them keep so much inside, and this is an opportunity for them to really tell how they felt and what they experienced.
It very much is. I actually am in connection with a lot of my veterans still. I go visit them. They've brought me gifts, and they've been able to just – we've made a connection on a professional and a friendship level that I think I will always carry throughout my life, and I know they will too.
Wow. So is there a special display this weekend for Veterans Day? Because you did mention that this is going to be at the Madden Library, you know, for people to come in and listen to any time.
Well, this is more of a permanent collection rather than a display. And we have already cataloged about 185. By the end of the semester, there'll be another 50. They're all – every veteran has their own envelope there. They can bring their relatives, their friends, and they're open for researchers. So it's more of that kind of a program.
Okay. Thank you both for coming in to share this wonderful project with us. And, folks, if you have the opportunity, take the time to go to the Madden Library and listen to these stories. And we thank both of you students for participating and taking part in this project. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Well, that is all for Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions, and you can also email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Winita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, Cahuilla Delta Medical Center, and Kaiser Permanente.